It's Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014, and you're listening to episode 335 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 42 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Stu.
And I'm Kimmy.
All right, joining us today, we've got Stu and Kimmy from Happy Jacks. These episodes have been well received, so we're going to keep doing them, whether you guys like it or not. But you do like it, so we're going to keep doing them for everybody's good.
Yeah.
But I do want to welcome them back to Fear the Boot. And also, we were just over on their show. If you did not catch that episode, then check the show notes, because I will give you a link to that. And you can hear, I believe it was Wayne and I, joining Stu and Stork. You can hear that and all the silly things we talked about and whatnot. It's a great show. We had a lot of fun doing it. So I'll put that link in the show notes. If you have not already heard what we did with Happy Jacks here most recently, not the prior shows, but the most recent one, then be sure to check the show notes so you can hear what we did over there.
If I heard correctly, you guys actually made the Earth move on that episode, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Yes. Yep. 5.1.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And that's all I'll say, because we have a standards on this show that I can't say anymore.
Wayne did give a joke about an earthquake that apparently took years, literally, to be set up. But if you want to hear that joke, you'll have to go over to Happy
Jacks. Okay, I
will
do so.
I think that made the recording. If that didn't make the recording, then ask me on the forums, and I'll... Okay, it did make the recording. All right, then don't ask me on the forums. I won't answer you. I am still actually behind. I was out for a week on vacation with Carla, Pat, Beth, and then my sister and her husband. Mm-hmm. And I am still, I got caught up on a lot of things, but I'm still behind on several others. So I apologize to anyone that thinks I'm ignoring them. Two announcements right quick. First off, I want to thank Cape Rust, who wrote a review of our Sojourn anthology over on the Pop Cults website. I want to thank him very much for taking the time to do that and the kind words that he gave us. We really appreciate the support, and Cape has been a good long-term friend of the show, so I really appreciate him doing that. If you've not picked up your copy of Sojourn yet, you can check the show notes for a link. We've actually given a dedicated site now at sojournanthology.com, which will list all the places that you can get it. And also, we did have a brief shipping issue with Amazon, because apparently they decided to be passive-aggressive based on which publishing house you're using. And so to get them to settle down and speed up the shipping chain, we went ahead and switched to one of their preferred ones. So if you had an order on Amazon that was moving slow and you canceled it, please go out there and try again, because it should go directly through now and be shipped at Amazon's normal speed. Or if you have an order that is still stuck in limbo and has not yet been shipped, same thing, go out there, cancel it, resubmit it, and it will go straight through. So we've got that issue sorted out. We knew there were some things we were going to learn on our first outing, and this has been one of the things that we've learned. So check out Sojourn if you've not already. The other thing I want to call your attention to is Jason Brick, who's another listener of Fear the Boot. Right now, he is participating in a charity for something called Hero Housing. And Hero Housing is a charity that basically works with impoverished people, particularly in the South. And what they try to do is go into these very deeply distressed communities, build housing for them, and also work with them on life skills. And you know, it's a really pretty similar to Habitat for Humanity. Mm-hmm. But it's done specifically through some of the martial arts organizations that he's involved in. He's got a black belt in karate, and he does lots of martial arts. Part of the ongoing work that he is asked to do by his martial arts organization is not just to better himself physically, but also to better himself socially and morally. And so he is doing a charity where he is doing a certain number of push-ups. And for each dollar amount given, he has to do additional push-ups within a certain period of time. I've already given to it. It's a great charity, great guy. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Please hop over there, take a look, and see if you can find it in your heart to give to that. And I'm getting that in now, because in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Derek on the show, who's probably going to guilt you out of a third mortgage. All right, let's get down to the topic for today. Today, what we are going to talk about, and I want to give credit where credit is due, because the topic here is not directly ours, but is something that I actually saw linked across an industry mailing list and found interesting, and thought that it would serve as a good basis for discussion. Because one of the things that people have asked us to go back to in terms of topics we've done in the past are common player and GM mistakes. Now, this isn't exactly that subject, and we'll still come back to that subject in sort of a redo episode here at some point. But there's an individual who goes by the handle of Your Friend Lane, and this is not on our forums. This is over on Reddit. And he put out a survey to GMs and got over 900 responses and collated that data. And basically what he tried to do, and of course, I realize that this is not, you know, scientifically perfect. It's got self-selection bias and all, but whatever. The point still is he got a significant number, I mean, nearly 1,000 GMs to respond to this and to give him some insight on what goes on in their worlds. And what we want to do is we're going to go down through some of the things this guy talked about in his survey. And I'll link the survey in the show notes. I fully believe in giving credit where credit is due. So I'll link the survey in the show notes. I want to go through this list and talk about the items he came up with, see where we agree, where we disagree, see where maybe we say, hey, yeah, there's a problem here, and here's some suggestions that we can talk about. And based on how quickly we get through this, this might be one show or this might be a series. We'll just see how it goes. All right. So, Kimmy and Stu, you guys ready?
We are ready. Absolutely.
All right. Pat, you ready to say nothing?
Absolutely.
Not on your game, are you? Let's start off with this one. This is one that we've heard from a lot of game masters. The majority of you GM more frequently than you play. No big surprise given the fact that the survey is aimed at GMs, but 39% of you reported that you GM most of the time, while 25% said that you GM all of the time. Wow. So you add those together and you've got about 65% of the people saying that they GM half or more of the time. Stu and Kimmy, I'm going to kick this one to you. What are your gaming groups like? Do you guys have a glut of GMs, or do you have that one poor sap who's always stuck in the hot seat?
We have a lot of people who are capable of GMing and a lot of people who like GMing different kinds of games. And at game conventions, all of us, I think, or nearly all of us, all GM con games.
Yeah, I would say that our group is larger than most gaming groups. I mean, we, counting everybody, we probably have a collective of over 20 people.
Yeah.
That are in a pool that we can draw from for different games. So I'd say ours is kind of like an abnormal sample, because if you have a group of 25 people, you're going to have multiple GMs. Most people who are gaming with a group of less than seven. Right. So there's going to be one or two that are comfortable with GMing. There are definitely those in our collective that are the go-to GMs. Stu's one of them, you know, people just kind of default, and they often are, you know, bring up the games and they are start looking for players and stuff.
Yeah, well, and we've kind of got the reverse of that, because the majority of us are GMs.
Right.
And so we kind of have the reverse problem of people start to get more picky about what they play and who they want to run what. It was kind of funny because I talked about some of this on our show and I got a lot of feedback from people saying, hey, come run an online game or something, because most people are desperate for somebody that would GM.
Right.
Your group really is an anomaly to have three quarters or more of the group be people who are not just willing to GM, but eager to GM, you know, chomping at the bit for their chance at the seat.
I think a lot of that's probably because you are so eager. In your group, there are so many people. Generally, there are only, you know, the one or two people who are willing to do it, so everyone starts depending on them. If you're able to share the responsibility, the GMs don't necessarily burn out, if you will. Where if it's the same people being relied on constantly, you know, they get tired.
Sort of. I mean, I like GMing. I like GMing more than I like playing.
Right.
Considerably. When I run a game, I'll basically go through my list of players, and I'll call the first four or five. And then I'll just keep going down the list until I have a full game. We'll run one or two sessions and then it'll peter out.
Right.
that's the way like,
because we're all busy and crazy.
70% of the games go. I mean, right. The L5R game didn't go that way. That went 13 sessions and then it petered out after first session of the next part.
No.
But I know, but there again, I don't mind running games. In fact, I far prefer that to playing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hate playing, but by far my choice in the hobby, my seat at the table is behind the GM screen.
Yeah, for me it depends on where we are. At conventions, I much prefer GMing. I honestly get a little nervous GMing games for you, Stu. It makes me very self-conscious.
It's because I judge you.
You do. You judge me. you're kidding. All our friends judge everybody. We're a bunch of jerks. But I feel more comfortable gaming with people I'm used to.
You know, I've got some guesses as to why this particular phenomenon occurs. So I'm curious if, now this is going outside the survey because the survey is aimed at GMs, but why more players don't GM? I would guess it's because of three things or some some combination of three things. One, there is now an onus upon that person to possess and to know the products associated with gaming. You have to go into the game store, find the books, fall in love with the idea, have that creative streak, pick up the product, bring it home, know the rules. Secondly, it's a lot more work. You have to create a universe, tell a story. You have to have a creative drive that basically says, I am going to do a lot of work, but it's not going to feel like work. It is going to feel as if it's fun. And then third, I think a lot of people are just socially nervous. They just don't want to be put in the spotlight. They don't want to be put under the microscope because they feel like that if they GM, they'll make, you know, they won't do it well. They'll make fools of themselves or whatever. In fact, a lot of the first time GMs that we've worked with, that has been their biggest hesitation going into it. And their biggest concern after the first several games they run is, how did I do? And did I sound like a doofus doing it?
They're just overly hard on themselves. I think you should just not worry about it as much and just try to have fun with it and don't worry about it, because I guarantee you most of the time, if not all the time, your players are just going to be so happy that they've got somebody else that's running a game. They're going to be very forgiving for the newness of it and anything else like that. So
I'm going to skip over a point of his here, because he mentions briefly that the higher your income, the more likely you are to GM regularly. And he guessed that this, and I say he, I'm going to assume Lane is a he. He says that the GM is stuck buying a lot of things, but I think that kind of ties into the point I just raised. So we'll move on to the next one. GM burnout is a huge problem. It says 57% of the people that responded said that while you love to GM, you just need a break sometimes. And it's furthered by the fact that a mere 6% of respondents stated that you'd rather GM than play no matter what. So only 6% of people in there said that they are just on the total cocaine-driven GM bender.
That's me.
The majority of people said that either they're suffering from some form of burnout or they consistently feel like they need a break. I completely would put myself in that category, and I pity the groups that have only one person that will GM, where it's, you know, either Bob GMs or we don't play.
Mm-hmm.
I have no good advice for Bob other than start training up your other players to GM or insisting that they GM.
Yeah, see, that's the situation that I was with when I started gaming, because back in the day, you know, I was brand new to gaming, and Phil was our GM, and he just ran for us for years. And I can understand, he did get to the point where he would get burnt out on a game. What he would get burned out on was, we had a longstanding campaign that we would run, and we'd play that for a while, and then he would eventually say, you know, I need to take a break from this. Let's play another game. I'll run another game so we can just have, you know, he could have a mental break from that. But what he really desperately needed was for somebody else to play for him, was to run for him so that he could actually play. Unfortunately, he didn't have that. So I empathize with that.
I'm in that 6% that prefer GMing all the time to playing. And I've only played in, I don't know, 4 or 5 gaming sessions since we started doing the podcast, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Maybe.
One of them was mine.
One of them, yeah.
That was terrifying.
But I far prefer to GM. It's probably because I'm a control freak, I think. But I like all the stuff about GMing. And playing is fun, but it's not as much of an investment as I like to make in this hobby. And I think that's what part of it comes down to.
I think that also can tie back with the size of our group, though, because you are also infamous for burning out on a campaign quickly. So I feel that if we had, like, 5 people who played in your game, and it was the same 5 people always playing in your game, they always wanted to play the same type of game, I think you would not enjoy GMing as much. But now you have this big player base that you can draw from, depending on what flavor of game you want to run. We also have a lot of people who are open to running lots of different types of systems.
Wow, the bus is really clean under here. Wow, thanks. No, I think that might be part of it.
Yeah.
More than anything, that's because of scheduling, and I throw up my hands and give up.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's how most of our campaigns die.
And yeah, absolutely. Mm. And a lot of that's me, so.
I am almost in the 6%. I definitely prefer GMing to playing by quite a bit, but I think I need breaks every so often, so I'm not quite in that 6%. And I will fully admit, one of the bits of self-realization I'm coming to is that I think in some ways I like the idea of GMing more than I like the act of GMing. That in my mind, the idea of running these stories and having all these people involved, and I suppose this is probably fueled also by past experiences where I've had really positive games. You know, it's like, that's what I'm looking forward to. And sometimes when that doesn't actually play out at the table, I start to burn out kind of quick and the campaigns fizzle, or as we've talked about past episodes, maybe I'm not even really running the game that I wanted to in the first place or any number of things, but that burnout does start to sink in and I find myself kind of fading quicker than I should as a GM. So, I mean, when you GM, look, I mean, for all the things that you're taking on, I mean, part of it is you are making a social commitment to the players there that you're going to see them through a story.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can't do a long story, that's fine. Do a short story. But if you sit down with stated intention to the players that you're going to run a big, huge campaign arc, then I really think the GM ought to do his or her best to make that happen.
Absolutely. I definitely think it's better for a GM to bring a story to a conclusion, even if it's, you know, sooner than the party necessarily wants, rather than just let something kind of fizzle out and die. So sometimes you have to make that choice.
She's looking at me with such judgment right now.
I'm so not. I'm very, very carefully looking past you at the screen.
Let me interject one little thing. Because I play so infrequently, and I probably since I have been playing RPGs, mm-hmm. including the first time I played in the sample D&D dungeon in like 78 or whenever that was.
When dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Yeah, shut up. I probably have only played in a game 10 or 12 times.
Right.
In
really?
30-some years. Absolutely.
Wow.
I have to say, when I have sat down as a player and watched someone else run, I always learn something about GMing. Because it's like a boxer watching game tapes of another boxer's fights, mm-hmm. right? And seeing the kind of techniques that people use, how they construct stories, how they lead players in certain directions, things that they do or that different groups do that some don't.
Right.
Every time I sit down and let someone else GM and just play, I always learn something or see a technique that I have not thought of myself or have not used in the past. I had one or two epiphanies in Kimmy's game when you ran your first game.
Yeah.
And one of them was about how much description you really need to give the players. And I found myself filling in a lot of details as you were describing things. You weren't describing things in minute detail. But in my mind's eye, I'm filling all of that stuff in. And mm-hmm. as you are changing the narrative, it's just changing right along with you.
Right.
And seeing it from that perspective, that changed the way that I started doing. I stopped obsessing so much about descriptions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, every time I've learned something.
Wow.
Yes, Stu, I'm right there with you, but I've also found it's a double-edged sword. Because I found that while I sit and watch other game masters like you, I tend to learn things about them, you know, and about GMing in general, just by kind of seeing how they handle things or hearing them give behind the scenes of what they were actually doing to make a particular scene work. And sometimes there's stuff there I can take home and use, but in many cases, when I see something and I try to integrate it into my own GMing, it doesn't work because that's the uniqueness of how that person thinks and how that person constructs stories. And when I attempt to integrate it into my own work, it's actually detrimental because it's just not the kinds of stories or the story methodology that really works for me. Or in, I suppose, in even a worse case than that, I see something that they do well that I know I don't do quite as well, that I might be strong in A and B, but they're really strong in C and D. And all of a sudden I start getting this imposter syndrome. You know, I start feeling like, well, my GM is not as adequate because I don't do setting descriptions well as so-and-so does, or I'm not as good at pacing the game as somebody else is. You know, even though I might have these other things like plot structure and all these other things really locked down, seeing what they do better than me freaks me out a bit. And when I try to take their techniques, sometimes I can integrate them and sometimes I fall flat on my face because I'm ceasing to be true to who I am and what I'm good at.
Oh, I think that's true. I mean, there was a guy who I co-GM'd with, Gammon.
Yeah.
He used to be on the show years ago. And he and I were co-GMing a Savage Worlds fantasy game. And we would sort of like hand off. I would run a couple scenes and he would run a couple scenes. And just watching the way he sort of led the players and led the narrative in a way that I can't do because I don't think people would trust me with that much control. Because he would say, like, they hear a noise out in the distance and they're walking down some path in the forest. And he says, oh, yeah, there's a noise out in the distance. Do you want to go investigate it? And they're like, yeah, sure. Okay, you step out a little bit. Give me a whatever roll. And they make their roll. And he says, oh, you can see a figure. Do you move forward to get a better look? Yeah. Okay. See, if I started asking those leading questions, they're like, it's a trap.
It's a trap. Everyone draw your swords. Get ready to die.
See, I haven't been in your group, but I feel the same way even just with that. Whenever somebody leads like that, I just feel like, okay, You know, it's just a little bit too much. I'm like, yeah, but I'm an overly paranoid person.
Right. Well, I think you also get used to the different GMs too. Like, Stu's the one nobody trusts because we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm the one who like will mess with your moral compass. Like, no matter what happens in the game, at some point you will come to a point where you don't know what's right. And then there's some GMs like Gammon who are very straightforward and they definitely throw curveballs, but it's more like you're willing to go along with it. I don't know. Can that, on the flip side, lead to player burnout of a GM if things start getting too predictable? Because I would think
Yes, absolutely. I, as someone who has done, in my career, mostly GMing, but if I look at more of the recent 5 years or so, I have done, I'd actually say probably more playing than GMing, if not more playing than GMing, then at least equal. But I'd say probably more playing than GMing. And I have definitely found that the longer that I'm under a game master in a particular story, yes, the more predictable and in some cases, the more frustrating it becomes. Because, I mean, look, the GM is a finite individual. As creative as they might be, as interesting as they might be, they really have a finite number of tricks up their sleeve. And eventually you start to learn them all. Mm-hmm. And I've had even people comment on this about me that, you know, when they're newer to playing with me, there's some things about my GMing techniques that they really love and that they really appreciate. But over time, they start to kind of notice these patterns. And I hate to use the word cliches, but maybe it's appropriate, you know, that these ruts that exist within my GMing technique.
Right.
And as a GM, you want to constantly be upping your game and learning new ideas and doing things the players don't expect and subverting their expectations and so on and so forth. But the fact is, you can't escape your finite nature as a human being. There's only so many things that you can do, and you're going to, by the nature of however you're wired, fall back to some of them more often than others. I mean, look, if you've been GMing long enough and you do voices for your NPCs, how many NPCs have had the same voice?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Every orc.
Every orc, yeah. You got the tough guy voice, the guy who sounds like you voice, and then the girl voice.
So yeah. Stu's tough guy voice is just him. It's just like him normal.
Yes.
The biggest badass in the world. Why make a voice? Why obfuscate what's really going on here? He even puts down the GM screen. Just like, look at me. Look at this. Look at this mountain of meat.
My eyes are up here. Stop looking at my breasts.
Pat would never say that.
No, I would never do it.
All right, this one didn't. This next one didn't. The answer did not surprise me in the least, but there's kind of a nuance to it that's somewhat interesting. When asked what their favorite aspects of GMing was, you guys want to guess what the two most common responses were? Favorite aspects of GMing. And this fits exactly. This is exactly how I would have answered.
Telling people what to do.
No.
No, I'm just kidding.
Control and TPKs were not.
Okay.
Believe it or not, sadism was not in the top
list.
Oh, okay.
That's no. Shocking.
Memorizing rules? No.
Yes. No.
What were they?
World building.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
And reacting to unexpected choices from the players.
Oh.
No surprise there, because those are exactly the two that I would have given as well. That's my two favorite aspects of GMing is world building and having my players surprise me.
Those are fantastic answers. I love those answers. I love the fact those are the most common answers from the GMs. That's great. It does surprise me a little bit, though, because that, like what Kimmy had said, that's sort of that control aspect was there. I would literally think that you're going to come from most people that what they're going to say is, I like being in control.
Yeah.
It's like, I like to GM because I like to be in control.
Well, and
sort of telling the story and being in control.
Here's the thing is, I wonder if that, because, Pat, while you have GM'd a little bit, you've almost exclusively played.
Yes.
I wonder if, to some extent, that is predominantly a player perception of GMs. And this is going to come up really in the next one. Well, we'll go ahead and skip ahead to it. It's kind of relevant, and then I'll skip back.
Mm-hmm.
What's the biggest cause of problems in games? Now, the answers do break down a bit, and I'll get into that nuance when we get to this particular point. But unsurprisingly, 41% of people said the problems were the players.
Right.
And right. So the game masters are left basically trying to cat herd. And I wonder if as a result, the players start to feel like they're being pinched or led or whatnot over or constrained over time.
Railroad.
And therefore interpret the game master as being more control oriented than the game master really wants to be. I mean, for me, it's all about I want to build something in the sandbox and then I want to see what you guys do with it.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what this survey said. And that may not be always how it works out. Because you guys may choose first thing to stomp all over the sandcastle and then take a dump on it. And I'm left trying to figure out how to reconstruct a game out of that.
Right.
Right. The interesting thing about that is I think most GMs probably are going to divide what we do up into prep and running.
Right.
Actually sitting at the table with the players. And it's funny that those are the two most common things. And they also have the two most disparate skill sets.
Absolutely.
Because the skills that you're going to use to prep a game have nothing to do with the skills that you're going to use to run a game.
No.
Stu, it's interesting that you say that because one of the things that Lane notes in going through the survey results here is that there is a jump in the ages. People that are 22 years and younger and people that are 40 and older prefer world building, whereas those in that middle category, 22 to 39, overwhelmingly prefer reacting to the players or interacting with the players. I think, broadly speaking, there are two ways to interpret that. Way number one is to say it's something that has to do more with generational preferences.
Mm-hmm.
Based on where you're at in your life and the sorts of entertainment you experienced growing up, you prefer one type of entertainment to another. The other is that based on where you're at in your life, and in this case, theoretically, all people would follow more or less along this curve, but just based on the factors of your life, world building becomes more appealing when you're either on the younger end or the middle-aged to older end, but kind of in that young adult to pushing middle-aged area, there's just something about where you're at mentally and socially that makes the interaction more interesting than the building.
I'm in the upper age bracket in there in that list, and I enjoy running a game. It keeps me sharp and keeps me on my toes, but I really like prepping games. Mm-hmm. Although I don't tend to do as much of it as I used to now, it tends to be more about creating characters or NPCs and the world building rather than trying to come up with, you know, the minutia of it. But I also kind of, when I look at that, I wonder if part of that is those of us that played old D&D back when that was the graph paper and drawing out your dungeons, and we cut our teeth on that, and that was really fun back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be the 40-something people now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was all about, I mean, let's look at what is that graph paper? It's world building. You draw out a dungeon, you put in your traps and monsters, you come up with a oftentimes very flimsy backstory for it. There were groups that were doing heavy role playing, but that really wasn't the norm of the way the hobby was pursued. That was something that, as best as I understand the industry, really didn't come around until the 90s, particularly with White Wolf and such, where role playing became a really heavy emphasis. And so it was really about creating scenes. It was, and by scenes, I don't mean like a scene as in a moment. I mean, scenes as in like whole sets, backdrops, you know, it's building the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
As someone who's in that middle bracket, the middle demographic, I would absolutely agree that that's how I feel about gaming. And I tend to pick systems, especially when I'm GMing, that reflect that. I tend to pick like Wild Talents, like the One Roll Engine, things like that, that don't necessarily require a battle map. Things like that, where it's much more conceptual based on like player choices and things of that nature. So I think that's kind of interesting.
So skipping down to the next one now. 41% of people responded that keeping the players focused at the table was their least favorite aspect of GMing. So in terms of biggest problems of GMing, about half of people said the biggest problem they had was their players. Now, here is something that I think is interesting, once it goes back to age, which is while that percentage reflects the overall population, if you break it down by age, Lane notes that the majority does shift within the demographics. Specifically, people that are under 30 overwhelmingly said the other players were their problem. But once they passed about the age of 30, session prep did overtake player problems as the number one hurdle to GMing.
So as you get older and mature a little bit, you realize and are able to take on the blame yourself instead of blaming others. Thank God. I'm glad to hear it.
Or life.
Spoken like a true player.
It could also be that as you get older, you learn how to deal with things maybe quickly and in a way that will cause less drama and more directly And also, if you're getting older, your player's getting older. So if I say to someone, dude, you're still on the cell phone. What up? Stop it. He's, oh, sorry. You know, and it's not going to become a big thing, whereas maybe it does when you're younger. At least that's the way it seems to me, looking at it from the old man's chair.
Yeah. Well, and I had a lot more free time when I was younger. Even just sitting in class, if the teacher's being boring, I would work on role-playing game rules and things like that. There was something that Johnny G quoted on the show once, and I don't know his source on this, so I can't back this one up. Maybe next time he's on, I'll see if he can tell me where he got this from. But he said that there's apparently some kind of study done on creativity, which found that while people may continue refining and releasing ideas well into their older years, that apparently most creative individuals will form the basis of their sort of repertoire, their bag of tricks, by the time they're about 25.
No, great.
Uh-oh.
And yeah. And I mean, I know you can find exceptions of somebody who came up with some grand theory or masterpiece or whatever that didn't occur until they were in their older age. But he said apparently the trend is that people come up with the vast majority of the really wild creative ideas when they're young. And then when they're older, they take time to mature those and to express those in a better way. And I don't know if that's a function of neurology, social situation. I mean, I don't know what precisely causes that. But I will have to say that this reflects my own experience, that my gaming groups, when I was younger, we had a lot of problems with cat herding, which we solved really through group character creation sessions and the group template and all these kinds of things. But I guess I just had to take for granted that those things must be fixing the problem, because now while those things do still occur, don't get me wrong, I do still have player dysfunction. By far, the bigger hurdle for me is finding the free time to really prep the game to the level that I feel is appropriate.
I feel like with this question, like it almost needs to be refined in a way, because 41% of you reported that keeping your players focused at the table. Does that mean, is it hard for them to stay focused on the game? Like, are they chatting? Are they off topic? Are they playing on their phones? Or is it keeping them focused on the storyline and without following red herrings and getting distracted that way? I'd be curious to see like the breakdown there.
I would be willing to bet it's cell phones.
That
99% of it.
I would bet that would change depending on the age group.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and even when it's not cell phones, it's just people being distracted, off topic, derailing the plot, so on and so forth. And I'm not reading everything this guy wrote verbatim, so go check this out yourself. But those are things that he does mention in the course of this. The likelihood of players, I shouldn't say likelihood, but the frequency with which it happens that GMs feel like players have done something socially to undermine the game. This one surprised me a little bit, and let me read it and then explain why it surprised me, but only a little bit. GMs overall are not big on pre-written modules. 31% of people said that they never use them, and either I mostly use my own stuff but occasionally use them, or I use them but only for drawing inspiration, pulled an additional 25% and 14% respectively. So all total is what, 56 plus 14, that's what, 70%? So 70% of game masters said they either do not want modules at all, or they do, but they just use them for little bits here and there, you know, like bits of inspiration from the artwork or little plot hooks and such. And here's the reason that surprised me, but only a little. That is exactly how I feel. I do not personally feel that modules, generally speaking, are flexible enough to get the kinds of games that I want. I personally own a bunch of them, and what I use them for is inspiration. When I'm hitting a complete creative wall, I take a module out, look at the artwork, look at the maps, look at the little box text, and maybe it'll just give me something like, oh yeah, that'd be a badass thing to work in, and it gets me going. But back when I was writing for AWOL Productions and later FASA for BattleTech, and then even later on into, you know, I mean, that was back in the 90s. So I mean, but then even on later doing Fear the Boot, one of the things that we have heard consistently is that people want more pre-built scenarios and modules. So there's one of two things going on here, which is either this guy's survey simply doesn't reflect the broader GMing pool. His survey sample just isn't reflective, or it is accurate, but the people that want those modules are a very vocal minority that's willing to vote both with mouth and pocketbook to get those modules and scenarios. In fact, that was, once again, back when my brother and I were writing for Battletech, that was one of the things they kept coming back to us for, was they kept using us again and again for scenario design. And they even at one point had our names listed in the writer suggestions as, and I'm not saying this pat ourselves on the back, I'm just trying to make a point about what the market's like. But they said, look at what these guys are doing. This is what we want more of. I was talking to somebody more recently in the industry. I think I remember who it was, but I don't know for sure, so I won't name drop here. But it was someone who, you know, was pretty well placed, who said that this is one of the things that really tends to sell well and be underproduced is high quality modules. And so on one hand, I'm surprised by this result, but on the other hand, I'm not. So I don't know what to make of this.
You know, we get a lot of emails from people who are saying, I'm running this adventure path, mm-hmm. or I'm especially Pathfinder people.
Yes.
And I have to wonder if somehow in this survey, those people got maybe underrepresented.
Yeah.
Because maybe these are people who aren't engaged enough in the hobby to go out and seek more stuff on the internet. So maybe they don't belong to this Reddit group, but maybe they do like to play a lot. Because there's certainly, nearly every publisher produces a ton of them, mm-hmm. and they're all over the place, and they seem to move. I own a few. Probably very early on, I ran an old D&D module or something, but mm-hmm. the vast majority of the stuff I've done has all been original.
Yeah, I would guess from just kind of the way a lot of these answers in the survey are leaning, that a lot of the people who answered the survey are more experienced GMs. And I think that adventure paths are a way that a lot of players get their feet wet and GM for the first time. A lot of the questions we get on our podcast with people writing in are people running adventure paths and who are brand new. This is their first try at GMing.
That's true.
So I feel like maybe they may not even completely consider themselves GMs at that point. Like, it's like, this is what I'm doing because we are a group that doesn't have someone who wants to GM. So I feel that that's kind of a support system, a way of them scaffolding when they don't actually have a GM.
The next one down is of the GMing aids that people use, there is a greater desire for aids that help during the running of the game, the execution of the game, than those that are used to prep the game. Now, this one was fairly close, meaning that what people were interested in ran somewhat. I mean, there's not like a 90-10 split on this. People seem to prefer things such as anything that would basically dig them out of, I need something right now and I don't want to have to come up with it. Pre-generated NPCs is a big one. Immediate plot ideas, like subplot ideas, not major plot, is like subplot ideas. These were all very popular things. And I can't say that surprised me a whole lot, because certainly within my GMing, while I don't use a lot of random tables or tools to really help me build the adventure, I mean, yeah, sure, to keep the information straight, yes. I mean, I'll use Google Docs or something for that. But where I really start to sweat and I'm reaching for random generators in terms, you know, online or numbered charts in some book, is when somebody asks me for something on the fly. My favorite question is, okay, so I asked the guard, what's his name?
I hate that.
You son of a bitch. It doesn't matter. He's guard number 3. And then they start this long interaction with him. It's like, okay, on the one hand, I'm glad you're interacting with my world. On the other hand, he's guard number 3. That's how he'd be listed in the credits if this was a movie. But you have to roll with that. And so all of a sudden I find myself, you know, if I've got a computer nearby or a phone nearby, I'll go to one of the random name generators that are online, randomly generate the guy a name, find something for randomly generating personality quirks just to give the guy or gal 2 or 3 obvious personality traits to make them not quite a cardboard cutout, and be like, okay, there you go. Here it is. You know, this is what's going on, because you just had to pull back the curtain and start asking questions I didn't want to answer.
Did you ever wonder if they're like actually testing you when they do that? It's like, oh, there's a guard, huh? What's his name? Oh, this is his name. Oh, is he married?
It's at least willful. It has to at least be willfully sadistic.
What's his wife's name?
I can give you good information, because if you've got that beat, his name's Joe, then you're like, oh, he's not important.
Oh, this so you're metagaming.
That's what I was going to bring up here. I think from a player standpoint, I don't know that it's necessarily that the players are doing it to be malicious or a dick. I think it's just sort of human nature. But in my playing, I have come to, it's one of the clues that I've picked up on. When I play, when some random NPC is nameless, I don't even give him a second thought. But as soon as an NPC gets named, my radar goes on. I'm like, important, you know, and you file that away because if he's important enough to have a name, he's not just guard number three. Now, conversely, on the very rare, the rare times that I have GM, I actually try to take that into account. And I like, I literally have a list of just random names, male and female, that I would have with me. And when they come up to a no-name throwaway NPC, I'll give them a name. It just to sort of to f- with the players, to be honest with you.
Yes, because that way, like, that
I don't know. Is it, he's got a name. He must be important.
It's important.
I found a different way of solving this, which is when I'm writing my game notes, if there is any individual they're likely to encounter, I will give that individual a name.
Oh, sure.
And even if I don't think it's going to come up, I'll put up like, you know, there are three guards. And in parentheses, I'll put three names down. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time on this. As I said, there are tons of random name generators on the internet. I'll link to one of my favorite ones in the show notes if you haven't found one. It generates first and last names, male and female. It does a great job. And so I can just run through that real quick and boom, everybody's got a name.
Yeah.
And because the names are completely random, and I even use the same generator for major NPCs, so there is really no difference in terms of the structure or thought put into important versus unimportant NPCs. And it doesn't take that long to do. I mean, sure, it's a little bit of detail work. It's a little bit of heavy lifting. It's not that hard. And heck, if you don't want to do that, then just go to that random name generator, grab the first 10 or 20 male names it gives you and the first 10 or 20 female names it gives you, and just check them off as you use them, or, you know, put them in a list. And as soon as you use them, like, oh, this was the gate guard at such and such town, just put a note in the margin next to the name. That's what this person is. So if they come back and ask, you can keep using the same name, but, you know, you don't have to use it on the fly.
Yep.
That's exactly what I do. Exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
The trap that it sort of saves me from is, why is everyone suspicious of the guy named Darth Dreadblade? Why do you guys think he's the bad guy?
But what? Not what did Phil.
That's right.
All right. There's a little bit more to this. I think we're going to come back to next episode. So as always, I want to urge you guys to check the show notes. Happy Jacks will be joining us for the next episode as well, because we're actually going to record these back to back, even though we'll release them separately. So I want to thank you guys for tuning in. Please do check the show notes. Look at all the stuff we got out there. Sojourn, the charity, the episode we did over in Happy Jacks, and all the little goodies we put out there. And thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Can I say see ya?
Sure.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.